to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. A weekly podcast where the discussion is about the most recent horror and genre films. Intelligent talk on a genre that deserves intelligence. A conversation between co-hosts discussing not only the film, but also the connotation that the directors and screenwriters are trying to articulate. When you want more than a review, listen to Dark Discussions.
And speaking of perception, there's just one more scene I want to talk about, which is after Caleb discovers that Kyoto's a robot, Kyoto kind of peels off her skin, showing him what's underneath.
Now, wait a minute. I know where you're going with this, but tell me you weren't already thinking this 15 minutes earlier in the film. Exactly what he's thinking at that moment.
Which is he's a robot, too.
Oh, I considered the possibility.
Right, and that's what I like, is the fact that the writers were smart enough to know that this is what the audience would be thinking.
We've all seen Blade Runner.
Right. Exactly.
www.darkdiscussions.com, wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I am here.
Very well. Yes, we are here. This is a special episode of Dark Discussions. Basically, it's going to be about a TV show and a specific season of that show. So we have a shortened co-host list today. However, we do have a special guest. But before we introduce that special guest, for Mike's wife, Pam, and anyone else who cares, we are recording this on September 25th at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And this is 2019. The special guest, who are you? Hello?
Hey, it's MJ Preston, but everybody calls me Mark.
Mark, how's it going, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Excellent. How would people know you? You written some books or something?
Oh, yeah. I'm a writer, and I've been on Dark Discussions quite a few times, actually, over the years. But also I've written 4 books. Actually, the fourth one isn't published quite yet, but I wrote The Equinox, Katie Event, and now what is out is called Highwayman, and it's a series. So that's how some people might know me.
That's right. We were just talking on a different Facebook group about the Evil Dead episode that we did, the remake, and how me and you especially hated that film.
Yeah.
It was kind of funny.
But we might have hated it, but I think it's one of the funnest episodes that you guys ever did, at least that I did with you. I had a riot.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun episode, no doubt about it. Who we are, for folks who are new to the podcast, once again, we are Dark Discussions. Basically, we talk about a genre film weekly, so sci-fi, fantasy, thriller, techno thriller, mystery, grindhouse, midnight movie, cult film, drive-in film, horror film, whatnot. And we try to critique as well as review. This week, again, it's going to be a season 2 of our television series. That's why we have Mark on, because his new series that he's talking about, he did a lot of research on stuff that is kind of related to the topic tonight. For folks who want to find us on the internet, we're at darkdiscussions.com. Facebook group is Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. And our email is darkdiscussions@aol.com. So if you're interested to email us, we will read your email on the podcast. Also, you can find us wherever podcasts are found. So that would be like Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Podbean, Overcast, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and I'm sure there's a few others that I'm forgetting, but wherever podcasts are found.
If you're listening to this, you can get it wherever you got this.
That's right. Eric, what else do they can find on the darkdiscussions.com?
Oh, they can find a whole bunch of stuff. On the front page, on the right-hand side, we have links to Friends of the Podcast. And up at the top, we have some links to different sections of the site. One section is the article section, where you'll find articles written by myself as well as others. There's also an audio link to the page that has a link to every episode of Dark Discussions as well as any of the spinoff podcasts available for free. And then on the front page, front and center, is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon lets you contribute financially to your online artists to help support them. Producing this podcast is not free. If you'd like to help us offset the cost of doing that, you can follow that link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We take all the entries from our patrons and draw them on a random basis quarterly to do a show based on a patron-picked topic. For more information, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com.
Now, question for Mr. MJ Preston. Where can people find your novels and where could they find you on the internet if they so desired?
Well, you can find me at my website, which is mjpreston.net, very simple, or .ca. And you can find my books on Amazon. The books are, I think I already said the books, so I won't say them again. But yeah, you can find the books on Amazon. Or if you're an audiobook person, you can find my latest book, which has just been released on audiobook, which is Highwayman. And that's available on Audible, which I believe is an Amazon company anyway, so. That's basically it. Or you can get me on Facebook.
All right, very good, very good. Folks can find MJ at all those places. And I believe on the right side of darkdiscussions.com, there's a link directly to his website, as a matter of fact. So people can go through the darkdiscussions.com website if they forget. All right, so I guess we can get into our topic tonight. So, Eric, what are we going to discuss Tonight
we are going to be talking about season 2 of the Netflix series Mindhunter.
January 1974. They just moved in 2 months prior.
A partner and I were first on the scene.
He was feeling for a light when something bumped him.
That's when we found the little girl hanging from this pipe.
Jesus. I found someone to take over who will be very good for the BSU. He wants to expand the unit, and he intends to make our approach practice.
Tell me, who's the one you want more than anything?
Manson. I'll get you, Manson.
This is $100,000, and it's all yours if you help us identify the persons behind the murders of our children in Atlanta.
Another child reported missing in Atlanta. I'm
sending you both. I want you there for the duration.
So all these children, one killer.
I believe that to be the case. It's statistically rare for serial killers to cross racial lines, sir.
It's also statistically significant that the Klan kills black people.
You get him out of there. If he blows this, Gunn will rethink his investment.
I'm asking you, as the leader of your department, what did Holden say that so offended the city?
We need to stay focused. If you're distracted...
I have some things to deal with at home. It's personal.
She had someone else's underwear stuffed down her throat.
It's 10:30. Do you know where your children are?
This is one predator.
What if you're wrong?
I'm not.
You arrogant, self-serving twerp.
We can't have tunnel vision, Holden.
What evidence is there to suspect the Klan?
Son, we've got 19 dead black children. You telling me that's a coincidence?
One more thing. Manson is small. Like, really small. Try not to stare.
That's right. This is the second season, as Eric mentioned. Mindhunter is a semi-factual kind of sort of, but not really, on the FBI and the creation of the serial killer unit. Season one came out, as Mike mentioned offline to me earlier, 2 years ago, where me, Mark, and Eric did an episode on it. And you can find that in one of our backlog Dark Discussions episodes. Basically, Joe Penhall is the creator of it. Stars Jonathan Groff, Holt McCallany, and Hannah Gross are basically the three leads. A number of side people as well. and it's been highly successful on Netflix, and they claim that season two has been rated much higher than season one, and season one was rated pretty good as well. So I guess we can get into I guess we don't really have to say how we heard about the season, you know, because it's been out for 2 years now. But what we felt about this new season, and then Eric, you can give us our wiki so people who don't know what we're talking about can understand what this is all about. So let's start with you, Mark.
Well, basically, what this is about is about the two FBI agents that kind of pioneered their way into profiling serial killers by going into prisons and actually speaking with them and working a program where they bring in a psychologist, and they're working trying to see if they can figure out if criminality is related to serial killers, if there's similarities, and if they can be, you know, put into different positions, but also to help them when they're chasing guys that are out there. So I would say that's the series, and I think it gets a smattering of police procedural too, where they go out and work on cases and whatnot.
And what did you think of the first? This season here, your personal opinion.
Because I overdosed on this stuff and read probably just about everybody. There was only one serial killer in there that I did not recognize in the series, but pretty much every one of these guys, I know who they are. I know all the details of their crimes, how they were caught and everything like that. That aspect of it is very, very fascinating. But I did have some issues with this season, and I'll get to them later. So I did have a few issues with it. But overall, I liked the series, and I will be back for season three, which I heard there's a rumor that it may not be 2 years until they come out with the season three. But at any rate, yeah, I enjoyed it, but I do have a couple of issues with it.
When you when you say not 2 years, you mean more or less?
No, they're saying. Oh, well, there was a. Well, I was looking it up on Google, and they said it could be as long as 2 years for the next season.
Oh, Jesus!
Oh, longer. Yeah. Okay. Mark, which is the serial killer that you weren't familiar with? I'm curious because I was familiar with all of them.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know his name, so that's the thing. But it was one of the okay, not Wayne Henley, because I know who Wayne Henley was, but there was one that they interviewed after that, and it was the psychologist and the junior agent there whose name
the one in Texas, the kid.
No, yeah. That would be Wayne Henley, because Wayne Henley was in Houston. Okay. But there was another one interviewed after that.
Okay.
You could probably pull it up on the Wikipedia, I'm sure.
Yeah, all right. I'm just trying to remember which one it is, because once you fill me in, I'll know exactly the killer. No worries. We can get to it when we talk about it. Sounds good. So, all right. So, what about you, Mike?
I blew through the season very, very quickly, which is always a good sign. I find it a fascinating show. I know they take some liberties at the margins of what happened in reality. There was one storyline that annoyed the shit out of me this year.
Okay, you and me are going to talk later, Mike. Sorry.
Yeah, and I'll explain that in more detail why. And I know that the highlights of the series are the interviews with the serial killers, right? Or at least that's the big thing that gets people coming in and talking, and the memes are, oh, look at this guy and compare him to the actual guy, and you know how similar they are, and how what great job they did casting, and these are all. And those interviews are all like fascinating to see, but they're 5 to 10 minutes in most of the 60 minute episodes. You know, there is more to the show than that. It is just a surprisingly well produced series. It's not something that I watch and go, oh my God, what, you know, like you know, watching John Hamm and Mad Men, and you go, oh my God, that's just a fantastic performance, or, you know, great set design or something. It's just well produced top to bottom, to the point where nothing to me really necessarily stands out, except I guess that serial killer stuff. And it's just captivating television to me.
All right, very good. Sounds good. Yeah, for me, I like this season a hell of a lot more than the first. I felt the first focused too much on Holden Ford and his neuroticism and his personal life. While this season, unfortunately, they do have some personal life stuff with Wendy Carr, which was probably the most boringest part and unnecessary part of the season. But I liked how it was more ensemble this season, and they focused more on Bill Tench's character, because I personally think Bill Tench's character is the most interesting character and the most relatable character on the show. I liked this storyline generally, because even though it's a fictional account, because the FBI agents are not real, they're based off of real people, but they change the names and all this other stuff. This serial killer here that they are going after, or land up going after, Wayne Williams, I remember it clearly as a kid, a daily on TV, and then when he was caught and all this other stuff. So it was very, exciting season, I felt, because it kind of brought all that back to when, as a 10-year-old or whatever, I was in developing and seeing the news for the first time and terrible things in the world and whatnot and whatnot. So, and it is curious too, about Wayne Williams, and we'll get into him later, and how the controversy around him, is here to even to this day, even though it's pretty much guaranteed that he did multiple murders, if not all the murders that he may be linked to. He's probably done at least 80%, I would say, based off of the fact.
Keyword being probably. There's no proof. Otherwise, they would have convicted him for those crimes.
Oh, there's plenty of proof. It's just they didn't bother because they already got him on the first two. They have all dog hairs, carpet hairs, all that stuff, all from his house.
That's evidence.
All the bodies. Yeah. Yes. Right. Well that, there's no. Go on, Mike.
Yeah, there's no proof. Proof is in the eye of the beholder. That's there's evidence for it.
Right. The only way there's 100% proof in real life is if they had it on camera, and we know the camera wasn't falsified. For all the evidence that they have, there's
I'm
no
not,
doubt.
I'm not saying he didn't do it. I'm saying that if they had enough evidence, they would have convicted him.
Oh no, they didn't bother trying him. And that's what, and they're pissed that they didn't because they wanted to save money, but because they already had him down for two murders, they said I wouldn't bother doing the rest of them. But you were saying something, Mark?
Well, I mean, look, the forensic evidence and the fact that he threw a bridge off the or a body off a bridge and they recovered it later didn't help his case much either, right? So, I mean,
right.
You know, I believe he did it. I don't think that he was.
I'm not saying I don't think he did it. I'm just saying that he wasn't convicted of it. That's all.
Yeah.
I think it's weird that the two they got him on, if I understand the case correctly, are kind of outliers compared to, right, because they were older.
Right.
So, look, I'm not going to lie. I wouldn't be shocked if he didn't kill all 22.
Right.
Sure he did more than his fair share.
Yeah, there's like 15 of them. Has the bodies all had dog hair and carpets samples that were all from him. You know, and it's just a little coincidental. But we'll get into all that. Eric, it's your turn. Go ahead.
I like this show. It's good. Basically, the part of the show that I find probably the most interesting is showing these people who have to interview these serial killers and investigate these horrific crimes and how it affects them as people and how it affects their lives. I find that to be the most interesting aspect of the show.
Sure, sure. And all three of them, it's different. One, I don't think it really affects them at all, except because, and that's Holden, because he is into it all together. While Tench, it affects his personal life.
I have to strongly disagree with you.
All right. Well,
didn't he end up in the hospital with a panic attack?
Yeah, all right. That's a good point. All right. Yeah. All right, I'll give
but
you that.
But I'd make the argument that that's a holdover from last season, and they kind of clean that up this season. Right. You know, and then they don't really do a whole lot with it the rest of the way in his personal life. It affects him professionally.
Right.
And in all fairness, when Ed Kemper, you know, threatens to twist off your head and then gives you a big hug, that could send you into a panic attack.
Well, and that's something that affected him in his job.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. Yep, no, hey. I see your point there. That's fine. That's fine. All right, so, Eric, do we have a wiki for this?
Wiki. It's basically what Mark said. Mark almost quoted the wiki here. Set in the late 1970s, two FBI agents are tasked with interviewing serial killers to solve open cases. Well, I don't know if that's not exactly what's going on, but whatever.
Yeah, that's a little of a falsified wiki because they're trying to
develop psychological profiles.
Exactly, so they can use that profile to determine the murderer, and that's the reason why Holden's character was adamant this season, because he pretty much believes it works 100%, and he says that the murderer in Atlanta's got to be a black person, while public relations wants it to be a white person because they were trying to say that it's they're racist crimes. Yeah, exactly. When in fact, that is not. And it's interesting too because it shows how 40 years ago, not much has really changed that much because ethnic groups, or I should say, racial groups in the United
politics
States.
And
yeah.
Shit.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of tribalism. It's still going on today, and I forgot how much it was back then as it is today, because it's interesting. All right, so I guess we can throw up the spoil, because we're going to talk everything and anything about the season, because, again, we're here to critique, not just review. So I guess we can start anywhere we want. I don't know who wants to start. Good to I don't know who.
Well, I'll just say that I do agree that Bill Tench became much more interesting in this season than he was in season one, and I enjoyed his journey through season two and where he ended up, even though it wasn't all good. It was very interesting to watch happen, and I found that character trying to balance his family life and his work life to be a really interesting and kind of dismaying, because you're watching him try to give what he can to both sides, and he just doesn't have enough to give.
Well, now we know why they truly changed the characters from the real characters. In other words, they made up characters that are semi-based on real characters. because Bill Tench, the character, the real person that he's based off of, nothing that happened in his personal life in season two actually happened to him in real life. It was all made up just to make another cool story.
I was assuming so. Yeah.
And that's where one of the issues that I got with the series, because I didn't think it was necessary, to be honest with you. Not at that level anyways. But we haven't got to that, so I'm not going to push it too much further.
could you explain further about what you mean by necessary?
I felt there's two elements, and you guys touched a little bit on it, you know, the whole Wendy thing and the relationship and all that. I thought that was completely unnecessary because I felt like it was more titillation for guys that get off on lesbians. And I also felt like it's like every time we make a series now, and boy, I'm going to get the crap beat out of me, and I'm going to give a disclaimer right now. I am not homophobic in the least. I have gay friends. But I felt that they feel like they have to insert this into this now. And the the real woman that she's based off, Anne Burgess. She's not a lesbian, but I you're seeing a lot more of this. It's like a trend in a lot of series now where they have to have that either the gay or the lesbian relationship. And again, let me say again, I'm not homophobic, but this just did, for what we're watching here, it felt completely, completely unnecessary to the series. And that's just the one thing. And then the other thing we haven't really scratched the surface on, so I really don't want to get into it too much until, but kind of like that was to add more drama, which I get. And I think maybe I'm tainted because I've read all the damn books, right? Mm-hmm. And that might be it too. So no, in all
I can
fairness,
understand how that could taint your view on this series.
Yeah. No, well, but I love the series. I mean, that's the other thing. I love the series. I really do. I just you know, I was a little bit more critical because what I said in the beginning was that with the last series or the first season, and I believe it was you, Phil, you said you found it was a bit more of a slow burn and you liked this season better. And I think that's because of the pace of the season, because it moved very fast.
Yeah.
And it was fluid. And when I say it was fluid, I'm talking about the case they were working, like you're saying, Wayne Williams and all that. That was absolutely beautiful the way that was done. I enjoyed that so much. But having said that, going back to the first season, that is what Mindhunter is, that book. That's it. Okay. So what I would have been interested to see is if they actually would have touched more of the exploits of Robert Ressler, who is Tench, or Holden, who is actually the producer of this show, also is John Douglas. So I would have been more interested to see, because there are other books that follow Journey into Darkness. Like John Douglas has written about 20 books and talked about his whole career. And in it, there is so much good stuff that they could have drawn from that we didn't have to have the whole thing with Tench. There were so many other interesting things that happened to these guys as they went up through the ranks and Quantico got created, behavioral sciences grew and all that. I mean, it's that, and like I say, there you again, I'm tainted because I read these books.
So is it fair to say that you personally find the real life story more interesting than the fiction they're creating?
Yes. Okay. Here's the way to look at it. If I had never read the Mindhunter books, mm-hmm. I would have absolutely loved this series and probably wouldn't have a critical thing about it except the Wendy thing.
Okay.
And that's just based on, like I said, I think that they're just inserting stuff for unusual reasons, or I don't know, whatever. But the series itself, and that's why I say it's, I don't know. Like I said, maybe I'm trying to be too much of a damn purist. But when I see something like them interviewing the Son of Sam, right? Mm-hmm. And Mike said this earlier. He said, you know, I mean, these people are going, oh my God, he looks like this, and it's only 10 minutes of this. But the thing was, is when they interview the Son of Sam, and maybe I'm jumping ahead one episode, okay, there was a revelation that the whole dog story was bullshit, mm-hmm. right? The messages and everything like that. And that's true. And so that little vignette inside this other encapsulated story was just like, that's fucking awesome. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
that's the way I felt about it. And like I said, I probably wouldn't be half as annoyed with the little things that they put in there that I felt were unnecessary, because it is a very well written, very well directed show. It absolutely is. It's just fantastic. And I will be there for season 3. Okay.
But this is like Silence of the Lambs. Everybody walks out of Silence of the Lambs talking about how awesome Anthony Hopkins was and how awesome Hannibal Lecter was, but that film would not have stuck around or been so successful if that was all there was to it. You know, it has to have all that other meat around it that holds it up. And those, certainly the interviews, are the highlights of the series, generally speaking, but man, it would be a shitty hour if it was only 10 minutes out of that hour. So the rest of it, like you said, is all really good. Let me ask you this about the Wendy thing. Would it have changed your mind at all if she was dating a guy? I mean,
I don't even think they should have had it at all. I don't care about their personal life. That's what the problem was with Holden in his first season one. It was like, I don't give a rat's ass about any of that shit.
Yeah.
But then you like Bill Tench's personal life.
Right.
I'm kind of with MJ because I knew it was all fake, so it was kind of like, eh. But I liked how he was one of the main focuses this season, and they broke it up to be more ensemble instead of just following Holden mostly.
Right, and see, I like the fact that they're... I don't know who Wendy is really based on, if she was really a lesbian or not.
She was based on Anne Burgess. She was the one of the three. There was Rob Ressler, John Douglas, and Anne Burgess, and they were the people that were portrayed in this.
Right.
But
so was Anne Burgess a lesbian?
No, not to my knowledge, she was not, no.
Okay. I mean, I've had that argument, and I don't have a problem with anyone who's gay. I'm glad to see more homosexual representation or representation of anything in things today. But I mean, I got in it with somebody because I said that if anything, homosexuals are now overrepresented in the media, and they got in a big argument. And said, because if you believe the statistics, 5% of the population is gay. And I'm seeing on just about every show now, there's at least one gay cast member. Now, you can argue this is overcompensating for years of neglect. I guess a lot of it depends on what circles are. I don't mind it because I don't think they went too far in the lesbian eroticism, or maybe I'm misremembering. I think it was they're trying to explore her character, and they were trying to do more with Bill's character. And they backed off of Holden's character a little bit, I felt, this season. But they are trying, certainly with Bill and with Holden, they were trying to get to how does studying these people affect them as people. And that's why they get into their personal lives. With Wendy, they're certainly showing that a growth in her character's development as a person, and her attempting to do things beyond just sitting at the desk at home base, doing a distance analysis, and her trying to get involved in doing the interviews and stuff. My biggest issue with, because I liked the stuff they did with Bill Tench and his wife, I just hated what it was based on because it is so on the nose and horseshit. There are so many incredible stories out there, ridiculous coincidences in real life that, those things that, if somebody wrote this, people would never believe it.
Right.
And there's a reason for that. Well, this is something where they did take a real incident completely unrelated to these characters and married it to something in a coincidence that is just way too hard to swallow.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's my problem. Now, if this really happened, I mean, it did happen, but if it happened to that guy,
which
I would
it
have
did.
To go, oh, but it didn't. And that's annoying. Now, do I believe that a person in his situation could have a troubled son? Sure.
Well, you know what this is.
You've lost me, Mike. Sure. You're going to have to go into specifics. I'm not entirely sure what you're trying to say.
Okay, so the thing with the son and the dead child and the crucifix and all that stuff, that really happened. I think was in Seattle or Washington State, somewhere in the Northwest.
It wasn't an FBI agent's kid.
And it happened in the 90s. Yep. So it was not an FBI agent. It was a completely unrelated story. Yeah. And then they superimpose that on Tench, because we already deal with the fact that he's got a troubled kid and he's got, marital difficulties, all of which are perfectly fine, given the job he has and the time demands it has.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fine with that. But they couldn't have just had him having a fight at school. They have to have him involved in the murder of a child and putting him on a crucifix.
Yes, he's already autistic or something like that, and they've got a strained marriage. So why do they have to throw that in?
Right. And he doesn't bring his work really home. I mean, he has his office at the house and all that, but it's not like it's affecting the home. The reason it's affecting the home is because he's away from the home, not because what he brings back home with him.
Well, if I remember correctly, wasn't there a scene of him looking at his stuff last year in the first season?
Yeah, season one. Yeah,
and that he had a glimpse of some of those.
He got a hold of a picture of a murder scene.
Right,
and the babysitter caught him, and she was all freaked out and everything like that. right? But caught the kid with that.
But honestly, I mean, that is horrible. But, you know, I mean, I remember when I was a kid and I would go over friends' houses and they would have, like, Fangoria magazines and all this stuff laying around. And those are pretty gruesome stuff.
Philip porn.
What's that?
I said that's Philip porn. that's another guy discovering Playboy magazine.
Yeah.
Phil, you go over there and find Fangoria.
Yeah, right. And you know, that's pretty gory and stuff and whatnot. So,
but that's all fake.
Yeah, but I mean, when you're that age, I mean, this kid is what, 7 years old, 6 years old. I mean, you could just lie and say it's fake. So I don't know. I don't know if that one picture would cause someone to go downhill that quick.
And that was another little thing I had a kind of an issue with, is that they had kind of an insinuation that Tench was beginning to worry that his child would become a killer, and that was in last season. So I kind of had a bit of a problem with that too, because I thought, where the hell is this leading us? And here we are. And like I say, I also found it just, it's like Mike said, you know, it's like, what are the chances in the universe that you're the first guy of a team, or actually, I guess, a trio, to coin the term serial killer, and then your child's involved in a murder of a neighbor of another child? You know what I mean? It's like,
This is where I think we're getting at, is that for me and Mark, for sure, and most likely Mike as well, when it gets into their personal lives of these characters, the show isn't that good. But
it's most of the show.
No, not really. Most of it is personal.
At least half of it is their personal life.
I don't know about that. A lot of it is the detective work or them dealing with superiors.
Well, see, like, what I liked about Tench this season is that his personal life was involved in his business, right? Because he's flirting with the girl down in Atlanta. You know, he's dealing with his health issues because of
you don't mean Tench. You mean
not Tench, Holden, right? Holden.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for Tench, you know, it is his work related stress. It's just when they bring the shit with the kid in there, it was just too on the nosy. And that's they shouldn't have done. I thought the way they handled a lot of the personal stuff I was fine with. If I like these characters, I don't mind spending time with them and developing them somewhat. And again, seeing how does doing this job affect you, you know, these things I'm sure affects these people.
It's an interesting story, but And most of the stuff that you see.
But do I care that Tench's wife left him?
Yes, she did, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, though.
Am I going to tune in next season to see if they reconcile?
I understand what you're saying about it being a little on the nose. I get that. At the same time, though, it had, like, in order for them to tell the part of the story that they apparently wanted to tell about his wife being in denial about just how serious the issues with their child were, it had to be something relatively severe, or else that really doesn't play quite as well. You know what I'm saying?
Well, there may
be. He's fine. He's just having trouble adjusting. And her husband's like, I think it might be a little bit more than that.
There are all sorts of traumas that they could have put this kid through, or issues, you know, in school or anything that
being bullied or something.
That would have been more realistic.
Yeah,
that would have been more realistic, and that kids really do have those problems.
It's a work of fiction. Why does it have to be realistic?
Because it depends on how much you're pressing the plausibility.
Right, and they're trying to make it plausibility. They're trying to make this as quote unquote, you know, based on fact and realistic and all that. So I would think this show should be a little higher than that. However, Eric is right. I did read a lot of reviews that people said that this is B movie type show, but the cream of the crop of the B shows. And so,
what's that? B show?
I don't know how to call it a B level show.
I'm just saying what other people said. So if they're saying that, they're kind of agreeing with Eric, which is, you know, this is just a show.
And honestly, I think you guys have more of an issue with it because you were aware of the real life events. I was not. I had no idea that thing was based on something that happened in real life.
And so I readily admit it, because like I said to you, I said if I didn't know about any of this stuff and I just watched the show, hey, it's a pretty cool show. Except for the Wendy.
Same reason I don't watch trailers.
No, but see, I have the normal interest in serial killers, but I haven't read all the books. I don't watch all the shows on Discovery ID or whatever.
Go to YouTube and type in serial killer.
I didn't say I don't have access to them. I just said I don't do that. That's not a thing I'm that interested in. I just have a passing interest, the way most people seem to have a passing fascination with serial killers. So I don't know all this stuff going in. But when you get something like this that proposes, you know, puts out there that is based on a true story, then as I'm watching it, there's always little things that go, oh, that seems incredible or maybe implausible or highly coincidental. And then I'll go check it. Or that doesn't seem to, I don't remember ever hearing about that. And I'll go back and check it and I'll see, you know, how much do they, you know, make it up. And, you know, after watching the first or second episode, whenever it is that you found the kid with the body, you know, I didn't stream it all in one day. You know, I had downtime. I went, I looked, did that really happen? And sure enough, no, it didn't, you know, but it just did feel still, even just watching, it was stretching plausibility, stretching credibility because they tell you it's based on fiction.
That's all. I guess we just have different viewpoints. Oh.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay.
It was sort of like it's sort of like the way Bohemian Rhapsody just completely fictionalized the final act of that film for dramatic impact. Made it a stronger film, but it was basically a lie.
Right.
And that bothers me.
Okay, fair enough.
All right, okay, so I don't feel as bad, Eric, about me disliking Braveheart anymore.
Well, you should, because you're a monster.
Yeah, and Braveheart starts by saying it's a legend.
But my point is that these things, historical things, bother other people as well, Eric.
Well, and they shouldn't, because it's all fiction.
You know what I found funny about this, though?
They claim it's partly fact.
Shush.
Okay, maybe we should really talk about the show instead. But what I found fascinating, and I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, was the whole buildup to Charlie Manson. You know, he was the fucking rock star of fucking murderers, and Holden couldn't wait.
Still
to...
is.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I know. Isn't that? And that's freaking creepy. Yeah. Man. But I mean, Holden was almost getting an erection because he wanted to meet Manson so bad.
Right.
Almost. And the fact of the matter is, everything I read on the real Charlie Manson, even, you know, those guys that do that serial killer art, they sell it all over the world. All these fucking freaks want to buy it. Okay. But they said that Charlie Manson, that's what these guys said, and this is the truth. Charlie Manson is a fucking lunatic, and they gained nothing from him. They didn't learn a thing.
Wendy didn't even want to go. She said, we shouldn't even go. He's worthless. Or Tench said it was one of the two.
Yeah.
And they were right. And basically what it came down to, they gave themselves their own out in the show, which is that she was like, this is worth it. This is not connected to what we're doing. And Holman was like, yeah, but it's Manson. Can we really pass up the opportunity?
Yeah. and he's kind of like, you know, meeting, you know, your favorite actor or musician or something and finding out they're just like an empty suit. And all the creative force comes from somebody else completely different, you know, or it's just not what you expected. You know, he's not America's first serial killer, but he's like he's not even a serial killer, but he's one of the first, but one of the first celebrity criminals like that.
Yeah. It was a high profile case.
And in the modern era, because obviously you had people like Jesse James, you know, or Billy the Kid,
Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde, but they were never put in jail in the modern media age on TV, you know, and, you know, and for everyone to kind of gawk at. And, you know, they didn't kill famous people, you know, they, you know, like he did, or like his family killed Sharon Tate and, you know, connected to Polanski and all the rest of that stuff that goes with it. There is a weird, speaking of, people wouldn't believe it, you know, if you wrote it, you know, that's kind of Manson.
Right.
Right. You know, the guy that used to live with a Beach Boy.
Yeah, I was going to say that. And
starts a cult that ends up murdering the wife of one of the preeminent directors of his era.
You're forgetting also, Mike, that she was like Margot Robbie is today. In other words,
a huge
breakout star. Yeah, exactly.
Right, and a budding star, and it's an incredible story that happens to be true.
And it's just such a weird thing.
But again, that's if you wrote it and pretended it was true, nobody would believe it. Right? No one would say, it's not a plausible story, but it's an implausible story that is real.
Well, you know, Mike, being immersed in this world for like the last 3 years, you wouldn't believe all the implausible stories out there. Like, I mean, it just blow you away that some of the stuff that happens, you know?
Oh, I know. H.H. Holmes is just.
Yeah. I mean, that is off the charts. They're going to make a movie out of that, too, by the way.
He was born in New Hampshire. I try to ignore that fact.
Phil. And here's a little, just something to throw out to your listeners, is that the guy that played Charles Manson, Damon Harriman.
Yep.
Same guy that played Charles Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And I got to give him his due, man. He did a fantastic job. I've watched a lot of Charlie Manson, and he just nails it.
And that's got to give you a weird complex. You know, it's like,
man, I'm really good at playing Charles Manson.
Man, I really remind him of Charles Manson. What the fuck does that mean?
I mean, we're talking about Charles Manson, but the guy that played Son of Sam and the guy that played Williams, Wayne Williams, was right on. It was so uncanny. It was like, holy shit, that's Williams. That's him. I saw him on TV when I was 10. I remember the whole thing.
Well, the same thing with the interview with Wayne Henley and the guy that killed Dean Corll in the big Houston mass murder that happened down there. I mean, that's
Phil, the candy man, right? The candy man.
Yeah, that's when you and I did our first interview together for Equinox. I mean, that's kind of what that character in my book was based off, that Dean Corll. That was one of the
next door neighbors.
I don't know why, but that did not get the publicity that, for instance, John Wayne Gacy, who, you know, killed all those kids in Chicago. For some reason, that story, which I think was even more horrible, because these two boys were.
It happened a couple of years before Gacy, too.
Yeah, but these two boys were procuring children to take to this guy's house so that he could rape, murder, and torture them for money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the guy that played Elmer Wayne Henley there, he pretty much nailed it too. I've seen interviews with him as well. They lined up everybody here, and what I do like about the series is how BDK is kind of opens up every time, and you're seeing what's going on with him, and he's evolving.
You know, that's our ultimate destination.
Oh yeah, you do. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's it's interesting that you know they're focusing on him. Obviously, maybe. The original behavioral science unit, you know, targeted him, but he wasn't as prolific as some of the others, like the Green River Killer and all these others that were even more famous than BTK, I felt. But I guess BTK is pretty famous, and I had no idea that he was that famous.
Well, people don't know this, but he happens to be quite famous. That's another thing I have an issue with this, just, and that's a story structure thing for both seasons, which is that BTK killer gets captured in 94, 96, 91.
Yeah.
You know, okay. So this is a series
that long ago.
That starts in 78.
74. 74 is when BTK started. Yeah.
No, I'm saying the series, the TV show.
No, but that's where the series is based around. It's before 74 because they've been following him as he goes, I believe.
Right. Maybe very tangentially. I mean, but I'm saying, but they start every episode off almost with a BTK thing, and it's kind of like, boy, if they don't make it to 1991, this is gonna be such a pointless prologue to every episode.
Honestly, it is kind of pointless because, like, for example, Kempfer and BTK weren't caught by the FBI. The only reason they were caught was because Kempfer, like you said, in season one, is he gave up. He just said one day, said, "All right, I fucked up. I killed my mother, so I'm done. So I'll call the cops and turn myself in." And BTK, the only reason they got him was because he was stupid, because he asked the police, not the FBI, the police, if they could trace the floppy disk back.
Yeah,
and they said no. And once they got it, the police were able to trace it back. So a lot of these killers, I don't even know why they're even in. I mean, I understand why Kempfer's in there, because they're talking to him. But the BTK, I don't get any of this, because the FBI really had nothing to do with capturing the BTK guy. So unless they're going to.
No, they went and profiled on him, though. That's the thing. That's what they're saying.
We're going to watch him in jail after, when they capture him, I guess.
Well, they may not capture him, though. But I mean, that's the whole point of that, is that even in the first season, we saw where they went to, remember that one cop there chastising Holden when he was talking about Charles Manson, and then they went to help him on a case, and then they told him they couldn't fucking help him. And the guy said, "Well, fucking thanks a lot," right? Yeah. That happens in police work. And that's the thing is, and I actually don't think it's a bad thing having BTK as a backdrop, because that was happening at that time, but it took them so long to capture him. And in what you said about the Green River Killer, that's where John Douglas actually did collapse working on the Green River case. And when he wrote the book about that, they still hadn't captured the Green River Killer. So I think that is an element of it, too, that of the series, is they're showing that there are guys that aren't going to get caught. And I think that's what's going to happen with BTK, because I can't see us going to 91. I just can't.
Well, they may go to 91, Singer has said, again, they didn't capture him. It wasn't the FBI that captured him.
Singer has said that there's going to be 5 seasons. And right. Somehow he has said one way or another there will be 5 seasons. So now, if Netflix pulls a Netflix and cancels it after season 3, then, you know, are they going to go to Shudder? Are they going to go to Amazon? You know, they have to, or is he going to film it in his basement and put it on Vimeo? I have no idea. But he's insisting that they're going to get there. I'm just saying, from a narrative structure, to focus on this one particular killer, and we're not destined to meet him and have that resolution for a long time to come, it just seems like a weird thing to do that risks having no payoff.
Right. Well, season one was, 77 to 80, and then season two is 80 to 81. And so if they have 3 more seasons, and the BTK is captured in 91, you said. So that's only 7 years. I don't know. That's only 10 years from the time we end season 2. But I'm even more concerned not on that. Again, I'm more concerned, like, the FBI didn't really capture him. So I don't know. Unless they're just trying to profile him or something. I don't know.
Well, but that's, like I said, that's what they – I think – and I don't mean to beleaguer the point, but I think the whole idea is, in the writing, is that police officers and federal agents, which are just police officers with federal badges, they touch cases that they don't solve, or they don't get solved in their tenure. And I'm pretty, even so, I don't even think Robert Ressler or John Douglas were even in the FBI anymore when they caught these guys. They were out consulting and stuff like that. I mean, Robert Ressler's dead now, but the point is that they still came across these guys. They still consulted. So it's kind of part of the story. And everybody knows who BTK is, right? Find me somebody that doesn't know. So, he was in the evolution stream while this stuff was going on. So I think it's kind of fascinating to have it as a little aside. But I'll leave it there.
Well, right. I also think, just in general, it's interesting because this is based, is set in the 70s. It's a period piece. And I think it's really interesting just how far behind they were just from a forensic standpoint at that point in time compared to what we have available nowadays, you know, from watching CSI and everything. We got all these modern technologies that make it much, much, much more difficult to get away with this kind of thing these days than back in the 70s. It seems like it would have been relatively easy to,
fucking DNA.
To skate by back in the 70s.
Well, Eric, the most brilliant thing that's come up in the past, 2 years, is they don't even need your DNA anymore. All they have to do is get permission from these online DNA services, the ones that, you know, you find out what ethnic heritage, you know, are you part Jewish, are you part whatever, and all they have to do is find one person on there who has DNA that's almost identical, and then they can follow that person right back to the murderer, because that murderer will be like, you know, the third cousin of the person on the DNA. So in other words, let's say my third cousin's a murderer, and I want to see if I'm, you know, part Arabic or something. So I do the DNA test, and I want to search for family and friends on that site. The FBI can now, or the state police can now, go on those sites, get the DNAs, because it's all there, and they can find my DNA, know that I'm not the murderer because I wasn't in Ohio when all the murders happened, and then they can trace one of my relatives that, or someone that I'm related to in Ohio, and then they know, okay, that's the person right there. Just because, so, you know, some bozo like me wanted to see if I'm Arabic, and then suddenly, boom, they can get anybody that's related to me now without even asking for their DNA.
Isn't there some litigation going on in that regard right now?
Yes.
Serial Killers of America, I believe, is litigating it.
Yeah. Because they're trying to say that it's private and all that, but they're debating that it's really not private, because the moment you put it out there, because you're looking for relatives or your own heritage or whatever, then it's open for anybody to use, even the FBI, if they want to come in and say, all right, let's here's Phil
Perkel. I'll be interested to see how that goes.
Right. Yeah. Cause it's a fascinating legal argument. And I imagine the main argument is going to be that this is not how you intended for it to be used. Mm-hmm. And the counter argument will be fine print, motherfucker.
Right.
This is not an iTunes update. You got to read the contract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Facebook. You know, right. Once you post a picture on Facebook, it technically is now in the public domain for Facebook to use.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right, but everybody knows now, right? If you didn't know before, by now you know Facebook is selling information about you. And it's a little disturbing to find out just how little you are actually worth to Facebook. You know, it's pennies a year. You know, it's not much. It's just that they have billions of people on it. That's where they're making their money, is in volume, not in thing. You mean your personal information is really meaningless. And if you look at the ads that come at you, they're, at least for me, I'm assuming your Facebook experience is not all that different. They're not all that great at targeting me.
I don't know how he got down this rabbit hole.
But nobody expects
Facebook
DNA
Facebook,
to be sold. That's a very different
there was this spot where you can dig deep into Facebook about what they determine you are, and it lists all these facts about you. And so I did it, and I'm listed as African American, which is kind of English.
Well, the point I was trying to make is that back in the 70s, they didn't have all the science and technology that they do today, which is probably one of the reasons that they came up with psychological profiling to begin with, because they were trying to find these guys, and it was problematic.
They show it perfectly in this too, right? Because they arrest the guy that was just beating off the magazines because he's a Christian and he's married and he was embarrassed, so he threw the magazines in the woods, and they just happened to be the same dumping ground that Wayne Williams was dumping people. And so they bring him in.
And he's a racist too.
Well, no, he wasn't. This guy wasn't. He was
Sorry.
And they're busting him, and then Ford Ford, meaning Holden Ford, keeps on saying, it's not him. Just let him go. It's not him. They go, what do you mean? We have his DNA and all that. It's a black man, because the only people that these kids are going to trust in a racist society of Atlanta is a black person. It can't be this guy. This is nonsense, blah, blah, blah. And it's all because of what you said, Eric, which is the psychological profiling and demographics and all that. And that's how they Holden Ford built it, along with, you know, Tench and other and Wendy. And sure. And he's pretty much right on 90-something% of the time.
Right. Well, and, you also know that if this was a Die Hard movie, Ford and Holden would be the square CIA agents or FBI agents that do everything, that come in there thinking they know how to do everything, while Bruce Willis, he knows what's really going on. You know, these, and they would be the pointy-headed intellectual types that don't have a clue, because it's all just fucking their theories, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's weird to see that they're using
in this show here, they're showing that science works.
Right. Well, because it has. It certainly did a lot more. But as with a lot of stuff that's psychological, it's not an exact science. Exactly. You know, and there is a lot of luck to it, but part of the luck is, you know, it's kind of like chess. People don't really think usually 20, 30 moves ahead. It's just that there's basic strategy. You put yourself in a position to exploit good fortune, and you go to where he's dumping bodies, and something should turn up there at some point, you know?
Right.
So that's why they accidentally nail the wrong guy. They're also in a position to nail the right guy.
But right. And that's one thing that's great about the show, is that they're showing how the public will say it's all crap because of one mistake, misleading information, and yet they ignore the other 98% that's correct, because, you know, hey, it's, you know, because, you know, they can use it for their own political gains and whatever. But are you going to say something, Mark?
Yeah, well, here's the thing, right? And this is where you're right, is that Robert Ressler, who would have been Tench, actually did go to a murder scene in Sacramento to profile. He was sent in by the FBI. It was right around when they were doing all of this stuff too, right? And an entire family was basically murdered. And the guy that played Tench, Ressler, he went to this murder scene, and he literally almost down to a T described this guy. He's going to be 29, loner. There's something wrong with him. Okay. And he didn't go in. The problem with the whole profiling thing is it's misrepresented today. It's like, even when you see in the movies where you see the guy's thinking and all of a sudden he's visualizing, that's a load of crap. All that profiling is a toolbox, and they throw in, okay, this guy's an organized killer. He brings his tools to it. Okay. This guy's a disorganized killer. He doesn't bring his tools. This guy's random. This guy's not. And that's all they do, and break it down. But also, with the science of it, they start looking at ages. They start looking at races. They start looking at all of these things. And that's what they brought it all into it. But it isn't an exact science. And even Ressler, the guy that did that, admitted. He said that you know, you're going to get lucky, but sometimes you're wrong, man. You know, like, that's just the way it is. So
right.
some people aren't, you know, in that specific character, or sorry, specific section of whatever they think it is. So sometimes people are outside of it. If I'm
right.
Jumbling around words, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely right. For example, Lorenzo Gilliard, who was the Missouri Strangler, he was a black guy, and his victims were all different ethnic groups. And same with Green River Killer, he was white, and his victims were all different ethnic groups too. And yeah. So. But you know, one of the thing is they say the behavioral science unit said that serial killers usually stay in their own race, for example. But that depends on certain things. So they have other, like you said, different toolboxes. So they said, all right, if it's prostitutes, then it could be the murderer could be anybody, because, yeah, you know, they're just picking up, you know, a good looking girl or an ugly girl or whatever. Easy girl, whatever you want to call it, and they kill the girl, and it doesn't matter if she was, you know, Latino, black, or Caucasian, and so that toolbox is different for that type of serial killer, because that serial type of killer, which was Lorenzo Gilliard and for the Missouri Strangler and then the Green River, where they were going after prostitutes. So prostitutes are just mixed ethnically anyway, versus, say, Wayne Williams, who was a serial killer who killed in his own race, as the another toolbox would say. And so that's an interesting point that you brought up, the toolboxes, Mark, because it's not an exact science down to the, you know, dotting your I's and T's, and, you know, crossing the T's. It depends on the type of murders that are occurring, and then that's where they choose different toolboxes. And this show so far hasn't shown some of those. They've shown just a handful so far. And,
well, they're just starting to evolve into it now, and you're seeing with the case with the Atlanta child murderer, right? You're seeing that in Holden now. And you're not seeing as much in Tench, but you see when Tench goes off on his own case, you get to see that how he's employing that as well. I believe it was Tench that went to see to the BDK murder scene there in the house where they hung the little girl in the basement and all that.
Yeah, it was.
So I like that. The flow of the show is really good. And I David Berkowitz, I was just sitting there going, holy shit, where did they find this guy? You know, like, because he really did nail it. And it's rather funny because I used to drive, out to Mass, New York and all that when I lived in Ontario. So, you know, I listened to a lot of radio at night because sometimes I was driving at night. And they had an interview with David Berkowitz because he's just in New York State. I don't know if he's in Attica, but he's in that general area. And
I forget where he is. I think he's Westchester County, so north near Poughkeepsie or something. But whatever, yeah. Jill's over there. Yeah.
But anyway, and he was being interviewed, so I heard his voice in the interview. And of course, he's not a young man now, but he was probably in his 50s to maybe 60s, and you know, this guy nailed his voice. I mean, and just his mannerisms, how he talked. And Berkowitz is asked never to be released now. But he was telling that to an evangelical preacher who would come in to interview him for Focus on the Family or something like that, because they want to talk about pornography. But anyways, that is what I find fascinating, because I've seen every one of these guys. But also, you know, just that they pulled up some obscure cases I like too, especially the Coral thing. And Phil, the guy that I couldn't remember, the guy, the killer, was Paul Battison. I'd never heard of him.
Which one was that? Was that the gay guy in the beginning? The one that was in the movie The Exorcist. Was it that guy?
He was is played by Morgan Kelly, if that rings a bell. But the real guy, Paul Battison, was sentenced to 20 years for the murder of somebody in New York.
Yeah, okay, that's the Exorcist guy. For people who don't know what I'm talking about, there's this actor that played one of the doctors, or not a doctor, or a technician, when they were doing...
the series The Exorcist?
No. Linda Blair in the movie, and he was an extra. And what happened was William Friedkin... liked the guy because he knew his stuff, and so he asked him to be in the film. And so the guy, this real technician guy, was in the film, and he, you know, was in all the scenes when she was getting the blood and the MRI and all that other stuff.
Okay,
and so he became a kind of a local celebrity after the movie came out. And then a few years later, he got arrested for murder. And there was rumors that this is another one, Eric, that he was put in jail for 20 years for one murder. But there's rumors that he may have killed like 7 or 8 other people, and they're not really sure. And then they asked him about it like 10 years later, and he goes, "Yeah, I'm completely shocked because he seemed like a nice guy when I worked with him," and that was it. Yeah, so it was a curious, weird thing about The Exorcist.
While we've been talking, I've been looking something up on Wikipedia, not directly related, but I had a hometown serial killer, and he was caught while I was in high school.
What's his name? Dan
in Rochester? Rochester?
No. Author Shawcross.
Yes. Yeah, that's somebody that I alluded to earlier.
Yeah, the Genesee River Killer. He murdered 12 women in Rochester between 1988 and 1990. He was caught at the beginning of 1990. He actually committed the murders in 89, I suppose.
He also murdered two children and was released from prison, and then he picked up and started killing prostitutes.
I saw his documentary where they interview him. He's a scumbag.
Yeah.
He's dead now.
Yeah, and one of the hall monitors in my high school fucking looked just like him. It was creepy as hell. Anyway, I was just looking at the Wikipedia page on him, and apparently Robert Ressler was called in. Because during his trial, he was trying to get off on not guilty by reason of insanity. And one of the things he was pleading was PTSD from having been in Vietnam. And it said that Robert Ressler reviewed the PTSD claim on behalf of the prosecution before the trial. Ressler wrote that, quote, his claim of having witnessed wartime atrocities was patently outrageous and untrue.
Yeah.
So he made the whole thing up.
And just to actually touch on that case a little bit, because it's one of ones that I read, the way they caught him was actually based on some of the profiling of what people did back in the 70s. And for instance, when they talked to guys like Bundy or a lot of these guys who would go back and revisit the sites where they'd killed somebody, and that's how they caught Shawcross, is they said, what we got to do is we got to find a body. And then we got to stake it out. And that's what they did. They staked it out. He drove down, was sitting there eating a sandwich over the body. And that's how they got him. But that comes back to, again, what these guys were doing, you know, by breaking down all the little things that they do and connecting the dots, which is that is fascinating. And especially what you said, Eric, about, you know, fuck, they had no DNA back then. Mm-hmm. Right. No, it was police work. It really was police. And I'm not saying DNA is not police work, but, Ted Bundy would have never got away with what he got away with. I mean, he left DNA all over the goddamn country. Every scene he left. He was having sex with the bodies.
Uh-huh.
He would have been hammered. And the interesting thing is today we are all documented. I mean, if you go in the army, you get your fingerprints done, or you know, or if you're a police officer, or you serve for the government or whatever. And sooner or later, your DNA does end up out there, even if it's in just a blood test. Somebody could. Possibly
they got my
it.
Fingerprints when I was a kid. They tricked me. It was at a Boy Scout expo.
Yeah. I mean, I saw someone post something recently. It was a half-assed thing, but like a post of serial killers in what years, like how many people they'd killed. And it was from in the 70s to early 80s, and a lot of famous serial killers. And it was trying to imply that it had something to do with, like, the Vietnam War or something like that. I don't...
Oh, horseshit.
I know it's horseshit. And it's like, well, it's that was around the time that they were recognizing serial killers, right? You know, as a thing. And they were taking it seriously and investigating. And it was just starting to get harder to get away with it.
Well, and yeah...
If you're going to kill somebody, the first thing you need is a time machine. Because right. If you want to be a serial killer, go be a serial killer in like 1837.
Right.
Yeah.
Because as time goes by and technology progresses, I mean, half the reason is harder, in addition to all the forensic technology that's improved, just communication technology. Because different states never fucking talk to each other. Different counties never talk to each other. Like, nobody ever looked at what was happening anywhere else besides their jurisdiction. So if there was somebody committing multi-jurisdictional crimes, they never connected the dots. And that's what started to happen in the 70s.
And this is a great way to
also, say. Also, don't forget cameras. I mean, that's how they caught the Boston Marathon bombers. Mm-hmm. It was cameras, you know, and so it's not just DNA, it's everything. But someone was saying something. Sorry.
Right, I was saying, like, if you go back to 1950, you know, if Eric murdered like three people in his town, he could then move, you know, to a couple of states later and change his name to Abe Spiney, and nobody would know the difference, right? Yeah. I mean, well, you know, and he could do it all over again.
Well, it's just to segue back into the series a little bit. I had a thought on that. It was that what I think is also cool about this is, and this really happened too, because Wrestler talked about it in his book, is that there was a mindset. And, you know, in the first season, we had that supervisor. I believe he was a supervisory FBI agent, but he was their boss. He's the big guy. He wasn't the director or anything, but he was the boss. And he was stuck up, and he didn't like, you know, he pissy, and he's trying to work through the bureaucracy, and he wasn't comfortable with it. And the fact of the matter is, when these guys got into this, they had to keep it secret. They couldn't tell anybody. And when the word blew that they were talking to Charlie Manson and guys like that, all of a sudden they got pulled up on the carpet, and Wrestler wrote a memo and crumpled it up and photocopied it like 9 times and stuck it in. Said, "Oh yeah, we said we were going to do this, right?" And the guy that was in charge then, they called him the Radish, I guess, because he had a beet red head every time he got pissed off. and then the new blood came in, and things really started to expand. And that's what I like about the series too, is because we're starting to see that there's more acceptance, right?
Mm-hmm.
One thing I didn't notice about it is I wonder if there was a change of administration at that time too, and that maybe things loosened up on the FBI a little bit, so that, you know, you had people who were more progressive in their thinking in government, and because, you know, politics plays into it. But I liked how they're starting to get a little bit more leeway to do their job, and I like the new boss.
Right.
So anyhow, just talking about the series.
And actually, that was what a weird idea. Actually, that was a scene I loved in the, I think it was the first episode, was that the retirement dinner.
Yeah. Right.
And when he just rips into Holden.
Yeah.
Like, you fucking idiot. Don't you see what's going on here?
Yeah. And that was just,
I was forced to retire. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he wasn't a great guy to begin with, but you feel bad that he's being taken the hit for Holden. And I feel kind of bad for Holden, because you just would how would you feel being in his position at that moment? You know,
right,
just,
right.
That's why I had
a panic attack.
Yeah, just so awkward. But just, again, it's just a well staged scene, and he's there. He's just trying to be all nice, and man, just, just completely, it's just like it upends his view of himself and his job. It was a good scene. It was just really well staged.
Yeah, I enjoyed how that one dude was trying to chase down Wendy, and she was just like,
oh god, that's right.
It's creep.
Yeah, that was the first call. Yeah, but
right.
Also, I think the whole focus of this was the Atlanta child murder investigation. And, you know, they were playing footsie with BTK, but really they were moving towards this Atlanta child murder. And that's, of the two seasons, I really enjoyed the first season, but I look at this first season as very static. How is this season had a really fast moving pace to it, you know, because they're moving back and forth on these cases. And like I say, the only thing that, you know, stumped me up was the Wendy thing. But beyond that, I mean, it was fascinating how they went in and then they got booted out because of the, you know, as Phil said, tribal politics. You know, we want it to be a white supremacist or somebody right. That hates black children. And then they got pulled back into it. And I think they did a really good job of kind of breaking down on how they got them. And I believe it's pretty accurate too.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways.
No, that was all really interesting. I kind of enjoyed how cocky that guy was too. I love the fact that with that scene where he goes to the mayor's house, that was pretty awesome.
Well, and actually that stuff actually did happen. So I was impressed that was why I remembered it so well, was because he was so much of a flamboyant, but attention getter. And, and he thought he was a rock star, and he thought they weren't going to get him. And you know, they did get him. And never mind all the other people that they could have tried him on, but they didn't bother doing, because they already got him. But that's why he's held on all these years to the end, where he still denies it. But they all deny it, which all the way to the end. anyway, but I watched a documentary of him recently too. After watching the show, I wanted to rewatch it. He was actually trained in some murdering techniques where he could kill people bigger than him, because when he was younger, he had gone to some sort of month CIA training thing. So it was kind of interesting.
So, I was about to say, where does one get trained in murder? But the CIA makes sense.
Yeah. So he was a little off anyway, and yet also he had some dark history even before he became a murderer. So it was kind of interesting to find that out about him.
Wayne Williams as well, but the gentleman that plays Wayne Williams does a very good job, but you would never peg this guy to be big right. enough to do the thing, because he killed one adult as well. He killed an adult.
It was two. We had two adults.
Was it two? Oh, okay. My error. But and that's an interesting aspect of it. The whole, you know, CIA training thing. Well, there,
it doesn't seem particularly threatening either.
No, he doesn't.
Just
no.
His mannerisms. He doesn't seem like somebody who's going to try and kill you.
Yeah,
which might seem like a stupid thing to say about anybody, because I guess anybody could technically be a killer, but you know what I mean.
Well, I was like the BTK, right? I mean, he was somewhat liked before they found out who he was, and so yeah, so a lot of these folk, some of them are weirdos and stuff. I mean, Wayne Williams was kind of a loser, they said, but all in all, they all don't seem like they would be the type to actually murder, which is kind of interesting. I mean, even Wayne Gacy, right? I mean, he was a selectman and some stuff. So it's just weird.
He was a selectman. He'd been pictured with June Carter, and he was somewhat of a local celebrity. He had a big construction company in the Chicago area, nobody figured him for it.
A high standing member of the not the Better Business Bureau, but the what's that group where all the businesses get together? I forget what that's called.
Better Business Bureau?
No.
Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah. So it is curious, but you're right though. Wayne Williams, you wouldn't guess, but when you look at him and you really talk to him after, I mean, when they've interviewed him and stuff, and who he was, most of his victims were, they were all like youngsters.
Kids.
Then it makes sense more,
Well, I mean, and how many of these guys? I mean, the story is always, oh, he's such a nice, quiet.
He's always so quiet. Yeah.
And other than Ed Kemper, because he was a giant,
A giant weirdo.
Yeah.
With an IQ of like 160, too. He was brilliant.
Right. Was he the one that was doing the audiobooks in prison? Was that
he still
Kemper?
Does. He still does.
Yeah.
He reads for the blind. He reads for the blind.
a couple thousand years of doing that, and that'll wipe his slate clean.
I don't know if this is based in fact or not, but in the first season, they asked him what they should do with him, and he was like, "You should kill me. I'm not going to be rehabilitated."
Kemper,
and I'm not defending what he did. There's nothing good about fucking an elbow or whatever it was that he was talking about. But
let's not judge people's sexual preferences.
That's right.
He killed a bunch of college girls, basically. Right?
Yeah,
he's pretty bad.
But he had a pretty fucked up mother, and he killed his grandfather and his grandmother, and they sent him to jail. And the fucking psychologist said, whatever you do, don't send him back to that fucking narcissistic woman that is his mother. And that's where they sent him. And I'm not defending him, but a lot of these guys, it's about hate for their mother. And so they go out and kill women because they haven't got the fucking gonads to actually kill their mother. And that's what basically Kemper said.
Did. So good for him.
And at the end, he surrendered. He said he was done. He got his release. Yeah. Well, actually, that's not true. He killed her friend, too. So,
he killed her friend too. Yeah,
but Kemper is I I heard, you know, both John Douglas and Robert Ressler, they said, of all serial killers, who do you like the most? They all said Ed Kemper, you know, like, because he's just very likable. He is.
Right.
And that's, I think a lot of that is his intelligence. But again, he demonstrated that he's still a very fucking dangerous human being, because he did threaten Robert Ressler and tell him he'd screw off his head and all that. Yeah. So, I mean, and this is a guy that they've been interviewing, for weeks on end and meeting, and, you know, they started to get comfortable with him. But at their base, these guys are all, they're predators. If they can get out and kill somebody else, they're going to do it.
Well, and Ed Kemper also demonstrated that if you really put your mind to it, you can achieve your goals.
Yes.
That's true. So I'm like, I was just going to say,
Ed Gein, when they caught him, he wasn't going to be corrected, but I guess when he was in prison, he never threatened anybody.
He was in an insane asylum, and he said, people treat me nice here. And I think he just wanted to have his mom back. And I guess the insane asylum became his mom. They fed him and took care of him. But Ed Gein killed three people. He killed two women, and he killed, they think he killed his brother, but they never proved it. But the thing about Ed Kemper really wasn't about that. It was the whole Texas Chainsaw Massacre thing inside his house with the house, you know, skulls made out of into soup bowls, and he was eating people, and he was a grave robber and all that. But he really, I mean, on the level of all these other serial killers, he didn't kill, you know, he was just crazy fucking guy that lived out on a farm and did really weird shit.
You could argue that within the context of the story, like the Atlanta story,
right?
The one of the big conflicts is the whole thing about it has to be a black serial killer. You know, you're looking for a black guy. Is how many people they were basing that on? Because we only saw them interview a few people in the first season.
Yeah.
You know, how much, you know, and they were just starting to classify. How many people had they classified as serial killers? How many people were they looking at? Because from the perspective of a viewer, he's going off this about like four or five data points, and that's not a good.
Well, had the impression that they were fast forwarding some.
Yeah.
And they absolutely were. These guys talked to hundreds of subjects. So they compiled this off of a very large subject. You're not getting that in this series, because it would turn into
Game
of Thrones, right? Like, I mean, it would be eight seasons and it would go on, and probably we'd all hate it.
Right, but then it would just something to give the – because then they were saying, oh, yeah, we've interviewed – and it mentioned they've interviewed the people that we've already seen them interview. You know, and nobody else are saying we've interviewed over 60 people or we've analyzed – just would have been – and I got the sense that they were probably, you know, shortcutting. I mean, on certain things, though,
right.
Gein was killing people in Kansas, right? So how many non-white people How many non-white people did he get a chance to murder? I mean, it really depends on
your
access, too.
Well, your access, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, it depends. Right, if you're in Kentucky or New Hampshire or Vermont, you know, it's all Caucasians. Well, if you're in Georgia, you know, it can be anybody.
Well, that is a hell of a gamble to take, right?
Well, us being the audience, rather than showing us hundreds of interviews and how they figured it out that it was going to be a black guy,
they showed the neighborhood test.
Yeah, the neighborhood test. So the, you know, these little kids, they would have a white guy, which would be Holden, going up to kids. Hey, kids, could you help me? Come in my car. And they go, fuck you, cracker.
Yeah, and everybody in the neighborhood's like, who the fuck are you? Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And then when they have the black FBI agent or cop do it, they go, the kids go, okay, sure. So the test was, they don't trust Caucasian folk. And for probably good reason at that time, anyway.
I was about to say that, yeah.
Yeah, and especially a policeman. And so that let us, the audience, know quickly what Holden Ford was trying to say, which is these kids that are getting murdered, they're not going to jump in a car or go with a white person. He ain't going to do it.
They're going to question whether you're a cop or a pervert. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. But I mean, the other end of it is too. I mean, think about this for a minute, okay? And I'll ask, all three of you are Caucasian. I'm Caucasian. But are you going to feel more comfortable in your home setting where you're, and I'm sure you have a multicultural community now, but back in the 70s, are you going to feel more comfortable in the setting of white people if you're white and black people if you're black? You probably are, because you can move in the shadows. Pardon me, I got a cold. You can move in the shadows and not be noticed in your own community. But left by color, you're going to stick out like a sore thumb. So,
well, and, you know, there are things that, not that people sit around and just talk about race issues.
Yeah.
But when you're with a different group of people that are not in the group that you are self-identified with,
yeah,
you kind of have to be on guard about what you say and how you say it a bit more, right? Because even if you, because if you say something and you misspeak, you know, if I'm hanging around with a bunch of white dudes and I say something that maybe could be construed out of context, and people, and you can go, you know what I'm saying, right? And
yeah,
people get, yeah, yeah, I get, I know what you mean.
As opposed, I'm going to take you off the hook there, Mike. What you're, yeah, you're trying to say is this: if two black guys throw down the N-word, you're not right. going to do that with them because you feel right. like you're being a brother. I'm sorry, but yeah, right. I get what you're saying. Yeah, exactly.
But you also can't talk about, you know, let's say the issue of police shootings comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in a room with just white guys. It's going to go differently than if I've got some black guys in the room with me. Even if they necessarily agree with me, it's, you're going to be really careful about how you approach that topic.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, if you approach the topic of like Me Too and sexual harassment with a woman in the room speaking as a man, you're going to be a little more guarded on the language that you use. Right.
Well, it's just, you know, we like to say how we've come leaps and bounds as a society from, you know, I mean, pardon me, black people can vote now. We've had a black president and, you know, yeah. And all race relations have been restored. But the thing is that we've become a society where it's easier to criticize somebody or to go after them. Okay. I've been criticized because of Equinox, because of cultural appropriation. I went and did a radio interview in Toronto and they wouldn't run it because of cultural appropriation. Because they always say, you know, and so, I mean, that's the society we've become. Because I think this is the speed bump we're all trying to get over so we can all get over to the other side, realize that if you're gay, it's okay. If you're black, it's okay. Can't we all get along, right? Well, when I was being interviewed by the person, there's another author that I know, and he was an international best-selling author, and he's a friend. And he was the first guy they kind of went after about that. So when I did this interview, they brought that up. And I basically just told them, look, I think white people should be able to write about black people. Black people should be able to write about white people. Straight people should be able to write about gay people. Gay people should be able to write about straight people. What are we doing, pigeonholing people, you know, based on cultural appropriation? It's nonsense. And they never said anything or shut me down. They just kind of backed off of what I said. They just never aired the interview.
Well, that was, wasn't Scarlett Johansson, who was being criticized for playing a transgender character. Yeah. And didn't she play like the
Asian character too? Well, she robot.
She played a character in an anime adaptation. And because the adaptation was an anime adaptation, it had to be Japanese. You know, they have to be Japanese.
Even though Japan, which is kind of funny, because even Japan, I think it takes place in China and Japan. And so they're not even Japanese. I don't know. Who cares? But yeah, I know.
I don't know. I know how we, we're kind of walking away from the series again.
Well, I'll explain how we got there. We got there.
No, I understand how we got there. I'm just trying to get back.
Okay, let's go.
Yeah, well, that's fair. Let's get back. So this is the reason why the FBI agent Holton Ford kept on saying it's going to be a black folk, because of all the scientific things, but they weren't going to explain that all to us on the show. So, you know, you may know, Mark, because you read the books, but how they showed it to us was the neighborhood test where the black kid says, "Fuck you, cracker."
Phil just likes saying that.
I think Phil does like saying that.
The whole point of the discussion was is that serial killers like to move within their own communities.
Yes.
Yeah, where they're comfortable.
And it makes a lot of sense because they blend in better and they'll be less likely to get caught.
And the whole point is to be a chameleon.
Right, and that's the reason why it's a different toolbox when the victims are prostitutes, because, you know, you're John, you're going into a area that could have mixed race, and even city serial killers are different than
rural.
For sure. And because, as Mike said, you know, if you're in Wisconsin, you know, you're most likely going to have just Wisconsin people,
right?
Caucasian.
But
and then
the
good one too is the weird one where it was the Washington D.C. sniper, and they were just they were black folk, and they were just killing. They were shooting all different ethnic groups. They just took out anybody. And
I got to applaud them for that. That was a big step forward for the serial killer community.
No, but the Atlanta killers, I found it to be an interesting dynamic in the show, because I get it. Like, if I was a black person living in Atlanta in the 70s, after everything that's gone down with police and KKK and everything, if there was somebody, a serial killer taking out black kids, I would want it to be a member of the KKK.
You wouldn't want to be a member of our own community.
But that's bizarre in a sense too, because the point, what everybody should be, is I just want them to be caught.
Right.
And that should be their number one focus. And they weren't. The number one focus was it better be a white nationalist motherfucker and not a black person, because it's just white folk trying to blame black for black crime.
Because they've seen that pattern before.
Right.
Right. That everything that happened, it's the black person's fault. And that covering up for what white people did.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to depict this community as it existed then, and it is still coming out of a very turbulent period of history. You know, people had lived through in their adult lives the civil rights movement, and you know, it the South, you know, and a lot of the police officers, like I said, there's a lot of police officers there that had involvement in the Klan and stuff like that, and here comes this guy from the federal government say he's gonna help, and you're expecting, based on history, this is going to be another racist, you know, Klansman or whatever other group of white supremacists there might be. And what does he do? He says, nope, it's one of you people that's doing it. And
No, he did not. He said it's a black individual. You're making it sound like he's a racist. He was not a racist.
Phil.
He's trying to interpret the point of view.
I'm saying that's the way they would see it. That's their point of view of it, right? Okay. They're not going to like. They're going to, oh, here we go. We're getting shafted again.
Here's the thing is, and this is what they touched on that you got to see in the beginning of it too. The black community was being minimized. Children were going missing in large numbers. And there was no police, there was some police attention being put to it, but really their task force, like, look, when they walk in the door and there's, you know, what, three or four cops, and they're all sitting around drinking coffee, you know, and there's doesn't look like anything's going on. So that was a sense of the time. So I could understand why they wouldn't want outside help, but also, basically,
you got to remember that based off of what we saw in the show, the black politicians were refusing to help the cops because, for obvious reasons, and the cops didn't have any money anyway, and there was no leads. I mean,
You're talking about a community that, has a very strained relationship with the police department. And at the same time, maybe collectively they're looking at it as, we're the victim and you're blaming the victim. And that's what they didn't want to accept in that, is that, no, there's no way.
And that's the thing that's bizarre. I mean, obviously, maybe not in that era in that mindset. But when you look at it, it's like, no, we're not blaming the victim. We're blaming one individual who just happens to be a black person that's killing other black people. But
that's not the frame of mind of the people at the time.
I agree. But I'm just trying to say that their perception, which is it's the white man or the blue devil, a blue-eyed devil, blaming us, and that's not necessarily the case. That's the perception, but that wasn't Holden. Holden was saying, no, I'm not blaming you. I'm blaming one individual who just may happen to be an African American who's killing young children.
He's also, and again, this is kind of what I was joking about with they're trying to joke about with the Die Hard thing earlier. This is the classic example of a guy who's coming in who doesn't know, who from their perspective, doesn't know shit about their community, doesn't know shit about their history, doesn't know what's going on in reality. He's just coming in with his theories, right? And that's going to do it. We all know.
They asked him to come.
Well, they did ask him to come because they were desperate, you know.
But there's politics working on both sides there, too.
Right.
There's the black community's politics, but also the hierarchy of the FBI. Say, hey, man, this could look good on our record if we help catch this guy. This could do something. So even their boss is thinking politically, too, sending them out there.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, and like I say, and the cops got so many resources. And, you know, did you notice with you had the one black FBI agent, but I don't remember seeing any black, except the one black cop that picked up all the kids. But most of those guys sitting in that room are all white, you know? And quite honestly, I think if you work in communities like that, and especially if they're slums, you become tainted. You know, you start to paint everybody with the same broad brush. But I really liked the whole dynamic that was going on in there as they're searching for this guy, because it's like, that's where I liked Holden as a character, because he was pushing upstream against all this resistance, right? The other part of his character, his crazy, you know, pot-smoking girlfriend from college and his breakdown, that didn't really interest me so much. But what did interest me is that what you see about Holden is that he is very, very intelligent. And that's why they're holding on to him. That's why Tench is still... You know, Tench. That's why Tench has stood up for him so many times in this series.
He's dealing with his bullshit.
Yeah, but he also sees in Holden this brilliance, and he knows it. He knows it, and that's why I think, you know. So, but yeah, and Tench is another character as well that I found extremely fascinating. I really like the guy that's playing him.
Well, and that's the other thing about the Holden's character that was interesting, too, because I didn't really like him in the first season. But this season, I did like him, because everything that he was doing, first of all, they didn't focus on his personal life, thank God. And second of all, they showed him as pure science all the way. And so when he's trying to hook up with the Atlanta woman, who basically he thought was asking him out, but in reality, she was just trying to... hook him up to help find the murderer. He came in completely as an outsider, you know, and he didn't care about the ethnicity or the heritage or all that. He was specifically looking, I want to just catch this scumbag. And he came in saying, with his science, it pointed out to be who he thought it would be. And it's absolutely right, Mark, where he's fighting everybody around him, because the FBI is saying, no, it could be a cracker, or it could be this white guy that was beaten off. I mean, we found, you know, whatever. And then the black folk are saying it's all the KKK. And yet he's going to trying to wade through all this bullshit between all these groups and saying, no, the science says this. This is it. This. And he's getting like beaten down continuously, and yet he's right 100% all the way to the end. And I felt that was awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I think they, out of those two characters in this season, we got a lot more. And, you know, I'm not going to go off on a point about any, like, tenuous situation or whatever, but if you want to keep going forward, I'm game.
Right. I don't know. We've talked mostly generalities, but
I really did like the women in Atlanta. I thought they
did too.
Really good performances. I apologize, I'm terrible with the names, and it's been a few weeks since I've seen it now. But the young actress who was the hotel clerk was really good, I thought, in her part, and very, very charismatic. I thought the woman playing the leader of the moms, and all the moms did a good job, but the one that plays, you know, where you buy her sincerity, and this is, by the way, a ballsy thing for them to kind of do, which is to put this mother, who is a sympathetic character, and yet have her being wrong and going against, you know, our...
Well, she still believes to this day, she still believes to this day that it wasn't Wayne Williams. So she has something, you know, she has some sort of agenda too. But again, you can't blame her because she did lose a child.
Well, right, but this is the people who have an autistic child. They want to blame someone. So vaccines. And it's there are just certain people in certain things and certain issues, and I won't go through all of them, that they're just not worth having an argument with. They feel right. The way they feel because they've been impacted by something personally and so deeply, and their cause has become their security blanket for that pain, and it is how they are dealing with it.
And I can actually interject something into that, yeah. Mike, because and I can say this because my father's long gone, but my father's sixth wife, I think it was. Anyways, her...
They weren't all, like, at the same time, right?
No, he wasn't, and he wasn't...
Because if they were, I mean, God bless him.
Anyway, just to quickly get to the story, his last wife that he had before he passed away, she had two children that took their own lives. And they were both boys, and they didn't take their own lives at the same time. They did it about 8 years apart. And she was convinced that the second one that hung himself had been murdered by his wife. And she held on to that for her whole life. And so, you know, people do strange things when they can't accept what is reality. And reality is that the gentleman had a drug issue and he took his own life. But who would think that a child would take their own life when, you know, he just saw his brother do it 8 years before and saw what it did to his mother. But that's what people do. And in this woman's case, I think it's a very similar thing, is that she just can't accept the fact that somebody from her community would go and do this to their children.
Well, I'm with Mike where the acting was fantastic and the characters were well done. But I did not like any of those characters. I didn't like them because I know the whole story. I know Wayne Williams. I remember it when I was a kid. I mean, this was daily in my life on TV and in the newspaper. And so I already knew.
When you were 11 years old.
Absolutely. I was delivering a newspaper and I was reading the newspaper, the whole newspaper every day when I was 11 years old. Absolutely. And I watched the news with my parents. Since I knew already that Holden was correct.
Because like they were David wrong?
They were wrong, and they were busting. Again, we're talking about a fictionalized TV show here. The characters said that...
Yeah, and they were wrong.
That's correct. Right, and they were beating him up continuously, and he's showing why he thinks this, and they refuse to listen to him.
I think it's a... probably, I can't say I wasn't there, but it's probably an accurate portrayal of how some people felt at the time. But speaking of people who can't deal with reality, I really enjoyed Tench's wife in this season, because she was just in such denial about their kid and what was going on with them, and she's so annoyed. I mean, they really kind of painted her as a shrew. getting constantly mad at Bill for going away from work when it's not like it's not different. It's not like this hasn't been the thing the whole time. And I just thought I thought it was interesting to watch Bill try and deal with her and deal with the situation with her son and try and balance the work and life without letting Holden in on what the hell was going on, because I guess he was embarrassed about having these issues with his kid, and eventually the fact that she took the kid and left. I mean, it wasn't a surprise, but I just love the ending of the season where he just like he just walks into the house and she's gone, and he just like sits down on the bed by himself, and that's the end of the season.
Now, Eric, since you brought this up, which is a good plot. Was the wife treated wrongly by the screenwriters?
I wouldn't say wrongly. I would say it's the way the character was drawn.
I'm sympathetic.
If some people were put in that position, they'd react the same way.
Right, because that's what I was going to say, is that with him gone all that time, and you know, obviously stressed in the job, you know, if they failed this case, they could close his unit and he could lose his job and all this other stuff. But if you have a child that has all these problems and he's not there to help while she's having to deal with it 100%, I guess, you know what I'm saying? So in other words, she was kind of, like you said, true, I guess. And yet, I don't know if it was fair for them to make us, the audience, feel that way, when if we have the whole story in her perspective rather than Tench's perspective, we would probably be on her side.
No, I understand what you're saying, but it's just she was acting as if he was doing it on purpose, and that wasn't the case, and that's where I thought that the line was drawn in between him being unfair to her and her perceiving it as worse than it actually was.
Well, but you know what? Look, the military, police department probably have the highest divorce rates in the world, because especially with people that leave and travel and stuff like that. I did 12 years in the military. I've seen so many marriages go down the toilet, where I've seen people get married and with, you know, them for years, and all of a sudden, you know, that's exactly what happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, and think about that. And this is where I'm going to call one more bullshit on this. Okay. Is you don't have your child involved in a murder, and you work for the FBI, and you manage to keep it secret from them. Bullshit. Yeah. Okay?
Right.
So that's another problem that I had with this, okay? His marriage could have went down the toilet. The kid's already got autism and issues and everything else, and he was being bullied at school or whatever. That's why I felt it was unnecessary, because if they wanted to work in the marriage angle disintegrating, I mean, that happens every day in the police department, mm-hmm. okay? Or in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, if you've got a field agent. Anybody that goes to the field or goes on tours, that's the risk that they run. So I think they could have went down that road, because that's where I kind of say, you know, it's bullshit. He's not going to keep this from the FBI. He can't. And he's going to lose his bloody job if he's involved in this because of the politics end of it, right?
Right.
I really enjoyed season two. I didn't have the issues with it that some of you guys seem to have, because I just take it as a piece of entertainment, not as a historical document. So I'm not looking for accuracy. And I was sufficiently entertained. So, I liked it, and I'm looking forward to season three.
All right. Sounds good. For me, I pretty much liked it. Almost 100% like Eric did. However, as we're talking about it, I mean, obviously I'm going to talk about, or I should say comment on points brought up by others. So, I have to say some of them are legitimate. So yeah, that's fine. But all in all, yeah, I love this season, too, Eric. Mike.
Yeah, it's a great show. You know, I have issues with one story element that to me stretched credibility. And we've talked about this before on the podcast, that there are, you know, it's a weird thing where there's, you know, different dividing lines. And I don't think, I'm sure if Holden flew down to Atlanta by donning a red cape and soaring up in the sky, we would all agree that pressing the idea of it being a fiction a little bit too far. So Eric's got a different line than I do, just in a different place. But that's what it's going to be. But it's a minor issue compared to a lot of other stuff. I did find the personal developments kind of compelling, more so than I did probably in the first season. I think MJ makes a great point that this is a better paced. And I think it's because you have this whole thing in Atlanta is an ongoing investigation, and you didn't, and that adds urgency to it, and you didn't have that as much in the first season. So and then you got those fantastic, you know, vignettes, the interviews with some of the, you know, sickest people who've ever walked the earth. You know, because that's what they did before they had podcasting. So, you know, season one, season two on Netflix, you know, catch them while you can, you know, sometime in the next 20 years. Yeah. And highly, 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 highly recommended.
Mark.
Same thing. I know I beat up on this season a lot, but I love the season. I love the show, and I'm going to go back and I'm going to watch it again. And I think the flow is really good. The acting is really good. I'm not going into the points that I already said because I think we beat it to death, but I'm definitely going to come back. It's a high recommend for me. I think it's fascinating. I think it's well written. I think hats off to Netflix. They did a fantastic job putting this together.
All right, very good. I mean, yeah, I don't even know. Is it a Netflix show? Did they put the money? Or, okay, so they didn't just buy it. They actually are producing it.
Yeah.
Okay. I did not know that. Yeah, so they are doing a damn good job, for sure. All right, so let's see. Mark, why don't you let folks know once more about where they can find your books and all that good stuff?
Okay, well, I'll just make a quick announcement because I know, you know, we're going to wrap this up. I just published my book Highwayman, which is a book series. It's the first book in a series of I don't know how many, depends on how long I live. It's now gone to Audible, so you can get it. And if you don't have time to read, you can always listen to it. It's available in ebook. It's available in print, apparently all over the bloody world. I haven't seen a royalty check yet, but. And they can get my books at mjpreston.net. Go to Amazon. That's probably the best place. Go to Amazon. If you get my book and you like it and you read it and you enjoyed it, please leave me a review, okay? We live for reviews. That helps sell more books, and it makes me write more books. Just as an announcement, the follow-up book to Highwayman is now in the publisher's hands. We just have to do the editing, and it's going to be going to print probably very soon. So that's it.
Right. Very good. So, serial killer books, right? That's what they're about?
Something yes.
Kind of, sort of?
Yeah.
There you go. So, all right. So, once again, Mindhunter season 1 and 2 are available on Netflix. That means they'll be there as long as the Netflix exists. And
which will be about another year.
Right. Yeah, the way it's going, I don't know. Yeah. But either way, go check it out if you're interested in this type of stuff. And with all that stated, Eric, why don't you leave us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about Mindhunter Season 2. This is a bonus episode, so I don't know where it'll fall in order, but I'm sure there'll be another episode of Dark Discussions coming soon.